welcome to the Book Report. Many of our recent shows have been about summer vacations. I'll share with you that I've just returned from India. As you might imagine, it's a trip that stays with you always. The beauty, the squalor, the progress, the poverty, and the promise. We saw so many amazing sights, of course, the Taj, but that's just the beginning. This was my second trip to the subcontinent, and the more you see, the more you realize we can never really know it. But there are some amazing titles that delve into the heart of the country. This show includes some of my personal favorites, and some new titles we'll explore together as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Paul Theroux, one of the true masters of travel narratives, has whisked listeners away on journeys to far-flung locales across the globe. For example, there's Dark Star Safari, which we previewed last year. Check it out on bookreportradio.com, archived shows week of April 2nd, 2011. Now I'd like to offer up a brilliant work of his fiction, The Elephanta Suite, a book that weaves together three captivating novellas. Each conveys the thrill and danger experienced by Westerners intent on losing themselves in the mystical splendor of India. Fidus Bamchi narrates.
They had come to Agni for their health, planning to stay a week. The week passed quickly. They stayed another. And now they renewed their arrangement from week to week, telling themselves that they'd leave when they were ready. They were world travelers, yet they'd never seen anything like this. Still, the file of monkeys hurried up the road with a skip-drag gait, the big, bold monkey leader up front, now and then barking in his severe, cough-like way. "Good evening." A man emerged from the twilit road, stepping neatly to allow the monkeys to pass by. The Blundens weren't startled. Their 3 weeks here had prepared them. They'd not seen much of India, but they knew that whenever they'd hesitated anywhere, looking puzzled or even thoughtful, an Indian had stepped forward to explain, usually an old man, a bobble-headed pedant, urgent with irrelevancies. This one wore a white shirt, a thick vest and scarf, baggy pants and sandals. Big horn-rimmed glasses distorted his eyes. "I see you are in process of observing our monkeys." Like the other explainers, this one precisely summed up what they'd been doing. "Do not be perplexed," he went on. It was true, they had been perplexed. "They are assembling each evening. They are taking last of warmth into bodies." He had the voluptuous and slightly starved way of saying bodies, giving the word flesh. "I figured so," Adi said. "That's what I said to my wife, didn't I, Beth?" "They are also looking at smoke and fires at temple in town." That was another thing they'd found. Indians like this never listened. They would deliver a monologue, usually informative but oddly without emphasis, as though it were a recitation, and didn't appear to be interested in anything the Blundens had to say. "What temple? What town?" the Blundens asked at once. The Indian was pointing into the darkness. "When sun is down, monkeys hasten away, see? to the trees where they will spend night hours, safe from harm's way. Leopards are there, not one or two, but abundant. Monkeys are their meat. Meat was another delicious word like body, which the man uttered as if tempted by it, giving it the sinewy density and desire of something forbidden. But he hadn't answered them. "There's leopards here on Monkey Hill?" Audie asked. The old man seemed to wince in disapproval, and Audie guessed it was his saying Monkey Hill. But that was what most people called it, and it was easier to remember than its Indian name. "It is believed that Hanumangiri is exact place where monkey god Hanuman plucked the mountain of herbals and healing plants for restoring life of Rama's brother Lakshman." Yes, that was it. Hanumangiri. At first they thought he was answering their question about leopards, but what was this about herbals? "As you can find in Ramayana," the Indian said, and pointed with his skinny hand. "There. Do you see mountain beyond some few trees?" And didn't wait for a reply. "Not at all. It is empty space where mountain once stood. Now it is town and temple. A shrine, so to say." No one mentioned any temple. "At one time was Muslim mosque built 5 centuries before, Mughal era, on site of Hanuman temple. 10 years ago, trouble, people invading mosque and burning. Monkeys here are observing comings and goings hither and thither." "I have a headache," Beth said, and thought, "Invading? A shrine?" "Many years ago," the Indian man said, as though Mrs. Blunden hadn't spoken. Was he deaf? Was any of this interesting? "I was lost in forest some 3 or 4 valleys beyond here, Balgiri side. Time was late, afternoon in winter season, darkness coming on. I saw a troop of monkeys, and they seemed to descry that I was lost. I was lightly clad, unprepared for rigors of cold night. One monkey seemed to beckon to me. He led, I followed. He was chattering, perhaps to offer reassurance. Up a precipitous cliff at top, I saw correct path beneath me. I was thus saved."
We've just heard The Elephanta Suite by Paul Thoreau. From Pulitzer Prize winner Catherine Boo, a landmark work of narrative nonfiction that tells the dramatic and sometimes heartbreaking story of families striving towards a better life in one of the 21st century's great unequal cities. Behind the beautiful forevers, life, death, and hope in a Mumbai undercity is a brilliantly written book based on 3 years of uncompromising reporting. Anawadi is a makeshift settlement in the shadow of luxury hotels near the Mumbai airport. As India starts to prosper, Anawadians are electric with hope. Abdul, a reflective and enterprising Muslim teenager, sees a fortune beyond counting in recyclable garbage. Asha, a woman of deep scars from a childhood in rural poverty, has identified an alternate route to the middle class, political corruption. And Kalu, a 15-year-old scrap metal thief, believes he is inching closer to the good life. But then, a global recession rocks the city, and suppressed tensions over religion, caste, sex, power, and economic envy turn brutal. As individual hopes intersect with great global truths, the true features of a competitive age are revealed. With intelligence, humor, and deep insight into what connects human beings to one another, readers are carried into hidden worlds. Sunu Mahotra narrates.
"Inside was carbon black, frantic with rats, and yet relieving. His storeroom. 120 square feet, piled high to a leaky roof with the things in this world Abdul knew how to handle. Empty water and whiskey bottles, mildewed newspapers, wadded aluminum foil, umbrellas stripped to the ribs by monsoons, broken shoelaces, yellowed Q-tips, snarled cassette tape, torn plastic casings that once held imitation Barbies. Somewhere in the darkness, there was a Barbie or Barbly itself, maimed in one of the experiments to which children who had many toys seemed to subject those toys no longer favored. Abdul had become expert over the years at minimizing distraction. He placed all such dolls in his trash pile down. Avoid trouble. This was the operating principle of Abdul Hakim Hussein, an idea so fiercely held that it seemed imprinted on his physical form. He had deep-set eyes and sunken cheeks, a body work-hunched and wiry, the type that claimed less than its fair share of space when threading through people-choked slum lanes. Almost everything about him was recessed, save the pop-out ears and the hair that curled upward, girlish whenever he wiped his forehead of sweat. A modest, missable presence was a useful thing in Anawadi, the sumpy plug of slum in which he lived. Here, in the thriving western suburbs of the Indian financial capital, 3,000 people had packed into, or on top of, 335 huts. It was a continual coming and going of migrants from all over India, Hindus mainly, from all manner of castes and subcastes. His neighbors represented beliefs and cultures so various that Abdul, one of the slum's 36 Muslims, could not begin to understand them. He simply recognized Anawadi as a place booby-trapped with contentions, new and ancient, over which he was determined not to trip. For Anawadi was also magnificently positioned for a trafficker in rich people's garbage. Abdul and his neighbors were squatting on land that belonged to the Airports Authority of India. Only a coconut tree-lined thoroughfare separated the slum from the entrance to the international terminal. Serving the airport clientele and encircling Anawadi were 5 extravagant hotels, 4 ornate, marbly megaliths and 1 sleek blue-glass Hyatt, from the top-floor windows of which Anawadi and several adjacent squatter settlements looked like villages that had been airdropped into gaps between elegant modernities. "Everything around us is roses," is how Abdul's younger brother, Mirchi, put it, "and we're the in between." In the new century, as India's economy grew faster than any other but China's, pink condominiums and glass office towers had shot up near the international airport. One corporate office was named, simply, More. More cranes for making more buildings, the tallest of which interfered with the landing of more and more planes. It was a smogged-out, prosperity-driven obstacle course up there in the Overcity, from which wads of possibility had tumbled down to the slums. Every morning, thousands of waste pickers fanned out across the airport area in search of vendable excess, a few pounds of the 8,000 tons of garbage that Mumbai was extruding daily. These scavengers darted after crumpled cigarette packs tossed from cars with tinted windows. They dredged sewers and raided dumpsters for empty bottles of water and beer. Each evening, they returned down the slum road with gunny sacks of garbage on their backs, like a procession of broken-toothed, profit-minded Santas. Abdul would be waiting at his rusty scale. In the hierarchy of the undercity's waste business, the teenager was a notch above the scavengers, a trader who appraised and bought what they found. His profit came from selling the refuse in bulk to small recycling plants a few miles away. Abdul's mother was the haggler in the family, raining vibrant abuse upon scavengers who asked too much for their trash.
That was Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. Second only to China in the magnitude of its economic miracle, and second to none in its potential to shape the new century, India is undergoing one of the most momentous transformations in the world. In India, A Portrait, Patrick French chronicles that epic change, telling human stories to explain a larger national narrative. Melding on-the-ground reports with a deep knowledge of history, French exposes the cultural foundations of India's political, economic, and social complexities. He reveals how a nation identified with some of the most wretched poverty on earth has simultaneously developed an envied culture of entrepreneurship. And, despite the ancient and persistent traditions of caste, as well as a mind-boggling number of ethnicities and languages, India has nevertheless managed to cohere, evolving into the world's largest democracy. With insight few Westerners could approach, Patrick French provides a vital corrective to the many outdated notions about a dynamic nation. Walter Dixon narrates.
There was nothing inevitable about India's rise, and Lakshmi uses the personal tales of the poor and the rich to explain how it happened. The third section, Samaj, is more nebulous. It is about broad social patterns and the characteristics that make India itself. The narrative shows things that might be taken for granted in India. The fact the untouchable father of the constitution was not allowed to sit in a classroom, the misconduct of the police and bureaucracy, the role of servants, the genetics of caste, the importance of India's many Muslims and their loyalty to the national ideal, and the deep and enduring influence of forms of faith. Through looking at the past, and sometimes at quite distant moments in history, the apparent peculiarities and continuing problems of the present can be revealed. Globally, India is now sometimes portrayed as having a competitive edge over more sluggish developed countries that have abandoned thrift, given up on saving, and refused to postpone gratification. Values that are embedded in an Indian way of life appear to have an unexpected relevance. A friend, Niranjan, forwarded me an email. It caught the idea that people like himself had a distinctive way of operating, and their lateral approach presented them with a new advantage. Like other Indians, Niranjan was taking pleasure in the possibility that the citizens of his country were highly motivated and no longer perceived only as the victims of famine or superstition. An Indian man walks into a bank in New York City and asks for the loan officer. He tells the loan officer that he is going to India on business for 2 weeks and needs to borrow $5,000. The bank officer tells him that the bank will need some form of security for the loan, so the Indian man hands over the keys to a new Ferrari parked on the street in front of the bank. He produces the title and everything checks out. The loan officer agrees to accept the car as collateral for the loan. The bank's president and its officers all enjoy a good laugh at the Indian for using a $250,000 Ferrari as collateral against a $5,000 loan. An employee of the bank then drives the Ferrari into the bank's underground garage and parks it there. 2 weeks later, the Indian returns, repays the $5,000 and the interest, which comes to $15.41. The loan officer says, "Sir, we are very happy to have had your business, and this transaction has worked out very nicely, but we are a little puzzled. While you were away, we checked you out and found that you are a multimillionaire. What puzzles us is, why would you bother to borrow $5,000? The Indian replies, "Where else in New York City can I park my car for 2 weeks for only $15.41 and expect it to be there when I return?" Ah, the mind of the Indian. With its overlap of extreme wealth and lavish poverty, its mix of the educated and the ignorant, its competing ideologies, its lack of uniformity, its kindness and profound cruelty, its complex relationships with religion, its parallel realities and the rapid speed of social change, India is a microcosm and may be the world's default setting for the future. Part 1. Rashtra, Nation. Chapter 1. Accelerated History. In Ladakh, the air is thin and dry, and it is cold even when the sunlight burns you. Tashi Norbu could remember how, in 1948, Buddhist monks in their dark red robes had built an improvised rocky airstrip near the monastery in Leh. Out of the sky came a buzzing metal shape, a Dakota airplane carrying India's new prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. It landed in a cloud of dust. "We had never seen a car or a motor vehicle at that time," Tashi Norbu said, sitting above his apricot orchard, speaking in a Tibetan dialect. He was an old man, an expert in medicinal herbs, water diversion, and the correct way to shoot a bow and arrow. He wore a long brown robe secured with a lime-colored sash, and on his head he had wedged a Homburg. There were no roads in Ladakh. A plane lands from the sky. You can't imagine. All the people put their hands together and prayed to the plane. We were all praying.
That was India, a portrait by Patrick French. Here's a fabulous novel from several years ago that lets you vividly glimpse some of India's many layers. Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts tells the epic journey of Lynn, an escaped convict who flees prison in Australia to disappear into contemporary Bombay, a hidden society of beggars and gangsters, prostitutes and holy men, actors and exiles. Accompanied by his guide and faithful friend, Prabhaka, Lynn searches for love and meaning while running a clinic in one of the city's poorest slums and serving his apprenticeship in the dark arts of the Bombay Mafia. The keys to unlock the mysteries that bind Lynn are held by two people, his mentor, Kader Khan, Mafia godfather, and the beautiful Carla, whose passions are driven by dangerous secrets. Based on the life of the author, this extraordinary debut has a world of human experience in its reach. Humphrey Bauer delivers an amazing performance.
It smells of 10,000 restaurants, 5,000 temples, shrines, churches, and mosques, and of 100 bazaars devoted exclusively to perfumes, spices, incense, and freshly cut flowers. Carla once called it the worst good smell in the world. And she was right, of course, in that way she had of being right about things. But whenever I return to Bombay now, it's my first sense of the city, that smell above all things, that welcomes me and tells me I've come home. The next thing I noticed was the heat. I stood in airport queues, not 5 minutes from the conditioned air of the plane, and my clothes clung to sudden sweat. My heart thumped under the command of the new climate. Each breath was an angry little victory. I came to know that it never stops, the jungle sweat, because the heat that makes it, night and day, is a wet heat. The choking humidity makes amphibians of us all in Bombay. Breathing water in air, you learn to live with it, and you learn to like it, or you leave. Then there were the people. Assamese, Jats, and Punjabis, people from Rajasthan, Bengal, and Tamil Nadu, from Pushkar, Cochin, and Konarak, warrior caste, Brahmin, and untouchable, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Parsi, Jain, animist, fair skin and dark, green eyes and golden brown and black, every different face and form of that extravagant variety, that incomparable beauty, India. All the Bombay millions, and then one more. The two best friends of the smuggler are the mule and the camel. Mules carry contraband across a border control for a smuggler. Camels are unsuspecting tourists who help the smuggler to get across the border. To camouflage themselves, when using false passports and identification papers, smugglers insinuate themselves into the company of fellow travellers. Camels who'll carry them safely and unobtrusively through airport or border controls without realizing it. I didn't know all that then. I learned the smuggling arts much later, years later. On that first trip to India, I was just working on instinct. And the only commodity I was smuggling was myself, my fragile and hunted freedom. I was using a false New Zealand passport, with my photograph substituted in it for the original. I'd done the work myself, and it wasn't a perfect job. I was sure it would pass a routine examination, but I knew that if suspicions were aroused and someone checked with the New Zealand High Commission, it would be exposed as a forgery fairly quickly. On the journey to India from Auckland, I'd roamed the plane in search of the right group of New Zealanders. I found a small party of students who were making their second trip to the subcontinent. Urging them to share their experience and travellers' tips with me, I fostered a slender acquaintance with them that brought us to the airport controls together. The various Indian officials assumed that I was travelling with that relaxed and guileless group and gave me no more than a cursory check. I pushed through alone to the slap and sting of sunlight outside the airport, intoxicated with the exhilaration of escape. Another wall scaled, another border crossed, another day and night to run and hide. I'd escaped from prison almost 2 years before. But the fact of the fugitive life is that you have to keep on escaping, every day and every night. And while not completely free, never completely free, there was hope and fearful excitement in the new. A new passport, a new country, and new lines of excited dread on my young face under the grey eyes. I stood there on the trampled street, beneath the baked blue bowl of Bombay sky, and my heart was as clean and hungry for promises as a monsoon morning in the gardens of Malabar.
That was Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. Mike Jarzik is an award-winning producer, audio engineer, and musician, having more than 25 years of experience in audio production as a recording musician and audiobook producer. For the past several years, Mike has been the executive producer for Audible.com, the leading producer of spoken word entertainment. He's produced hundreds of audiobooks, dozens of which have been nominated for Audio Awards and Earphone Awards. His audiobook with Woody Allen received a Grammy nomination for Best Spoken Word Project in 2010. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right. I think our listeners believe that all audiobooks are produced by the big publishing houses. So what sorts of titles does Audible produce?
Well, that's a great question. Audible at one time was basically a digital bookstore, and then they wanted to create more content, and they just weren't getting enough of it. So they decided to become a producer of audiobooks as well. And that being said, we are the largest producer of audiobooks right now, and we produce all kinds of audiobooks, all the different genres you can think of, sci-fi, from sci-fi to romance, and everything in between.
Tell us a minute about how you got into the industry.
Well, you know, it's the old story of, an old studio rat like myself. I was the chief engineer for Viacom at one of their satellite studios up in Stamford, Connecticut for about 7 years in the mid-90s. Early 90s, I should say, and a friend of a friend got a job at Talking Books, which was the commercial arm of the American Foundation for the Blind in Manhattan when they were at 11 Penn Plaza. Unfortunately, now they're no longer, and said, you know, you have a knack for the spoken word thing, recording this. We did a lot of VOs and things like that and directing them and that kind of thing. And once I did one session, I fell in love with the whole process, you know, the actors, everything about doing an audiobook. And I was there as a freelancer for a long, long time. And then Audible decided that they wanted to become a producer of audiobooks and set up a studio. And another friend said, well, you should hire Mike to run those studios. And that's it. And I've been here for 8 years at Audible.
All right. Well, those of us who love audiobooks know that narrators can make or break a title. For example, there's been a huge flap about the narration of 50 Shades of Grey. So tell us a little about the process of selecting a narrator.
Well, you know, here at Audible, there's many ways you could do that. There's casting directors and producers. Here at Audible, as the executive producer, I have, and graciously, Audible allows me creative control of casting and hiring of the narrators and such. I have two producers that also work for me because of the volume, certainly, that we do here, that they also cast the book. So we act as producers and casting directors. Now, that it's a skill in itself, and we look at every book and try to match the right book with just the perfect narrator. And it is a craft in itself. You have to have a great knowledge of your talent pool, and you have to really love to read, and you have to love the spoken word and the acting job that is.
So what happens when an author wants to perform their own work and they're, shall we say, a better writer than a narrator?
Yeah, that's the old joke in the industry, isn't it? But, you know, that being said, I mean, I think, you know, and I'm all about the authors, too. I think, you know, they sit there and they pore over their words, every word. Now, they're not actors, and I think that the people that are purchasing the books on Audible for download by an author know that, and they're not looking for a performance. They're looking for that person to speak, you know, to narrate his words to them or her words to them. And I think in a genre like business, for instance, there's great value in having someone, you know, who wrote the book give you that information. I think there's great value in that.
One question I've had, because I have a lot of friends who have self-published, how would an author who is self-published go about getting an audio recording of their book and getting on Audible?
Well, there's a great new site that we've launched called ACX, and it's the Audiobook Creation Exchange, and that is a way for rights holders. So if your friend has the rights to the book, the audio rights, they can meet up with a producer in this marketplace online and get the book produced in audio and up onto Audible. And Audible is basically the facilitator of that, and it's been a great success.
Wow, that's huge. Tell us again where someone could get information on that.
Yeah, if you go to acx.com, you'll everything. There are FAQs. There's all information about it. It's been a big success, and I highly recommend everyone check that out who's interested in doing something like that.
Wow. All right. Tell us, I was talking with Steve, my fabulous producer over there. How long does it actually take to record a book, and then talk about the editing process?
Sure. Well, it varies by production house, but at Audible, the rule of thumb is it's a 2-to-1 ratio. So for every 2 hours in the studio yields 1 hour of audio. And that's how we base a lot of the budgeting on what we do. So a 10-hour book, when it's all said and done, when it's edited and such, takes 20 hours to record in the studio. The editing process, we allow 3-to-1. We do what's called a punch record. So it's basically every mistake is kind of captured, you know, corrected in the studio by having the engineer stop, play back a little bit, and the person picks up where the mistake was. So you're basically giving the editor a very, very clean record. Normally, we get books done very quickly. A book can be completed, depending on the length, as fast as a week and as long as 3 weeks, depending on the length of the book, totally in the store and done, as we say.
Yeah. And, I mean, how many hours a day would the narrator be performing the work?
Right. At Audible, and there are places that have different, but here at Audible, we have two shifts that run 7 days a week. We have six studios. They run two shifts 7 days a week. The shifts consist of 6 hours a shift. So it's usually like 10 to 4, and then the next one starts 4:30 to 10 or 11. And so they're in the studio a good 6 hours. They take breaks, lunch, all that kind of thing.
That seems like that's a lot of recording in a day, but I guess they're used to it. They're professionals. Where do you see the future of the audiobook industry heading towards?
Well, it's definitely a growing market. I think that, you know, certainly downloads are trending. CDs are going away, in my opinion. A lot of it is a lot of the CD market now is our libraries and such, but I think it's a very bright future. It's one of the fastest growing facets of the acting community for sure. I mean, we have an outreach program now with some of the top acting schools in the country. We teach workshops there. I've taught at Stella Adler and Juilliard, and we're getting fantastic young actors interested in this form of acting, and it's potentially quite lucrative for certain people, and I just see it as a very, very bright future for audiobooks.
And can you share a story about when you were working with a celebrity that we might know recording a book?
We recently recorded Thérèse Raquin by Emma Zola with Kate Winslet, and it was one of the best experiences I've ever had in the studio. Kate is very, very down to earth and has quite a potty mouth, but in a good way. And she takes pride in it. And she's very, very smart. We had a great time. She was extremely knowledgeable about the book itself. She's read it many times and developed the characters. It was a very, very, very good experience and quite a creative boost to me. And I really enjoyed working with her.
Well, Mike, this is really a fascinating look into an industry that we all love when we tune into this program. So thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime. Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Joseph Lelyfeldt's Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India, is a highly original book on the Mahatma. It chronicles his achievements and disappointments, his success in seizing India's imagination and shaping its independence, and his recognition late in life that few of his followers paid more than lip service to his goals of social justice for the country's minorities, outcasts, and rural poor. The author, a Pulitzer Prize winner, shows how Gandhi's philosophy and mission were shaped on another subcontinent during 2 decades in South Africa and then tested by an India that quickly learned to revere him while following only a small part of the way to the social transformation he envisioned. Here is a vital, brilliant reconsideration of Gandhi's struggles and his fierce, but finally unfulfilled hope of his legacy as India's social conscience. Mark Bramall narrates.
Often in those days, these were people who'd actually encountered the Mahatma, who'd come into the national struggle fired by his example. So more than a patriotic ritual was involved when they claimed to be his heirs. Yet it was hard to say what remained of him beyond his nimbus. An occasion for asking such questions occurred with the approach of the 100th anniversary of his birth in 1969. Setting out to report on the remnants of Gandhi's movement, I followed Vinoba Bhave, his last full-time apostle, as he trudged through the most impoverished parts of Bihar, then, as now, among the poorest of Indian states, trying to persuade landlords to cede some of their holdings to the landless. Vinoba collected deeds to thousands of acres of barren, untilled, and untillable land. The Mahatma's aging protege seemed stoic, if not tragic, as he saw his doomed mission through to its largely inconsequential end. He became his admirers. That's Auden on Yeats. 3 decades ago, V.S. Naipaul used the line to characterize the decline of Gandhi's influence in his last years, when he was most revered. The combination of piety and disregard, hardly unique to India, lasted as a cultural reflex, surviving the explosion of India's first nuclear bomb. Over time and at a distance, my experiences of South Africa and India ran together in my mind. Gandhi was an obvious link. I found myself thinking again about the Phoenix settlement, to which I returned twice, the second time after it had been burned down in factional black-on-black violence accompanying the death throes of white supremacy, only to be restored with the blessing of a democratically chosen government eager to canonize Gandhi as a founding father of the new South Africa. I then found myself thinking about Gandhi himself, wondering how South Africa helped to form the man he became, how the man he became in South Africa struggled with the reality of India, how his initiation as a political leader on one side of the Indian Ocean foreshadowed his larger disappointment and occasional sense of failure on the other, whether, that is, there were clues to the end of his journey as leader, in its beginning. I'm hardly the first to raise such questions, and won't be the last. But it seemed to me there was still a story to be uncovered and told, themes that could be traced from the beginning of Gandhi's political life in one country to its flourishing in another, with all the ambiguity of his legacy in each place. The temptation to retrace my own steps while retracing Gandhi's finally proved irresistible. This isn't intended to be a retelling of the standard Gandhi narrative. I merely touch on or leave out crucial periods and episodes. Gandhi's childhood in the feudal Kathiawad region of Gujarat, his coming of age in nearly three formative years in London, his later interactions with British officials on three continents, the political ins and outs of the movement, the details and contexts of his 17 fasts, in order to hew in this essay to specific narrative lines I've chosen. These have to do with Gandhi the social reformer, with his evolving sense of his constituency and social vision, a narrative that's usually subordinated to that of the struggle for independence. The Gandhi I've pursued is the one who claimed once to have been trying all my life to identify myself with the most illiterate and downtrodden. At the risk of slighting his role as a political tactician, a field marshal of nonviolent resistance, or as a religious thinker and exemplar, I've tried to follow him at ground level as he struggled to impose his vision on an often recalcitrant India. Especially recalcitrant, he found, when he tried not just its patience but its reverence for him, with his harangues on the crime and curse of untouchability, or the need for the majority Hindus to accommodate the large Muslim minority. Neither theme, it turns out, can be explained without reference to his long apprenticeship in South Africa, where he eventually defined himself as leader of a mass movement.
That was Great Soul by Joseph Lelyfelt. While Galileo was suffering under house arrest at the hands of Pope Urban VIII, and the pilgrims were struggling to survive in the New World, work began on what would become one of the seven wonders of the world, the Taj Mahal. Built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan as a memorial to his beloved wife, Mumtaz Mahal, its flawless symmetry and gleaming presence dazzle all who've seen it. When I glimpsed it for the first time, it seemed to hover above the ground and not be earthbound at all. The Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire, by Diana and Michael Preston, tell the story of its creation and its fascinating blend of cultural and architectural heritage. The book also offers up a first look at the magnificent history of the Mughal Empire, beginning with the legendary warriors Genghis Khan and Tamerlane. If you're planning a trip to India, pick up this title before you go. It's sure to enhance your visit to this wonder of the world. James Adam narrates.
Eleanor Roosevelt visited the Taj Mahal just after dusk and wrote, "I held my breath, unable to speak in the face of so much beauty. This is a beauty that enters the soul." Fittingly, another woman, the wife of an early 19th century British Army officer, best captured the sublime intensity of the love that inspired the building. She wrote simply to her husband, "I cannot tell you what I think, for I know not how to criticize such a building, but I can tell you what I feel. I would die tomorrow to have such another over me." By the end of the 18th century, the British artist Thomas Daniel, who produced some of the best early paintings and plans of the Taj Mahal, could write after his visit, "The Taj Mahal has always been considered a spectacle of the highest celebrity, visited by persons of all rank and from all parts. The Taj Mahal's celebrity has only grown over succeeding centuries. It is an international icon, and, like the Statue of Liberty, the Eiffel Tower, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and the Great Wall of China, one of the world's most readily identifiable structures. Despite being built by an occupying dynasty, it is a symbol of India, adopted by numerous tourist organizations, restaurant owners, and manufacturers in India and worldwide. It has also become a symbol of enduring love." By the time of Princess Diana's visit in February 1992 to India with her then-husband, Prince Charles, the power of the Taj Mahal's image was such that when she visited the Taj alone and allowed herself to be photographed, a single, disconsolate and melancholy figure seated on a white marble bench before a monument to an abiding royal romance, no words were needed. The Taj Mahal is an expression not only of supreme love, but also of confident power and opulent majesty. It was the creation of an emperor whose dominion stretched westward across the Indus into present-day Afghanistan and Pakistan, eastward to Bengal, and southward to the central Indian plateau of the Deccan. Shah Jahan's ancestors, the four preceding emperors, had acquired these huge and hugely wealthy lands by persistent opportunism. Descendants of Genghis Khan and Timur, they had been pushed out of their traditional territories on the plains of Central Asia, beyond the mountains of the Hindu Kush, by fierce rivalries among the rulers of the local clans. In the early 16th century, under the leadership of Babur, the first Mughal emperor, they had begun probing down through the Khyber Pass into Hindustan, northern India. Their hold on their territorial gains had at first been precarious as local rulers had forced them back. Not until the reign of Babur's grandson, Shah Jahan's grandfather Akbar, from 1556 to 1605, was the Mughals' hold on India secure. With stability and prosperity came the opportunity for the Mughals to indulge their traditional aesthetic interests. Nostalgic for the cooler climes they had left behind them, they had a particular love for exquisite gardens, cooled by fountains and streams and with airy pavilions in which to relax. They were the prototype for the gardens of the Taj Mahal, and several survive to this day. The emperors also became enthusiastic builders, constructing in their new lands fortresses and palaces, and within their pleasure gardens their own beautiful mausolea. They brought with them a tradition of tomb-building which they developed over the years into a unique fusion of Islamic and indigenous traditions. The fabulous wealth of India, piled high in the imperial Mughal treasuries, enabled them to build mausolea of extraordinary magnificence and sophistication. Shah Jahan could literally stud the Taj Mahal with jewels, inlaid into the building's white marble to form the glowing flowers of an earthly representation of the heavenly paradise where Mumtaz awaited her grieving husband. The Taj Mahal was the Mughal Empire's ultimate artistic expression, emulated but never equaled. However, it extracted a high price from its builder, Shah Jahan, in every sense. Creating this heaven on earth was an almost impossible undertaking, physically and financially. A contemporary English traveller wrote, "The building goes on with excessive labour and cost. Gold and silver esteemed common metal and marble but an ordinary stone."
We've just heard The Taj Mahal by Diana and Michael Preston. If you're not familiar with the depth and breadth of India's writers, The Book Report presents the work of Amitav Ghosh. One of his early works, The Shadow Lines, opens in Calcutta in the 1960s and follows two families, one English, one Bengali, as their lives intertwine in tragic and comic ways. The tale is told through an Indian-born and English-educated narrator, who traces events back and forth in time through years of Bengali partition and violence, and provides keen observations on the ways political events evade private lives. Raj Varma narrates.
"Sometimes Tridib would drop in to see us without warning. My grandmother, for all her disapproval of him, would be delighted whenever he came, partly because she was fond of him in her own way, but mainly because Tridib and his family were our only rich relatives, and it flattered her to think that he had gone out of his way to come and see her. But of course, she knew, though she wouldn't admit it, that he had really come to nurse his stomach. The truth was that his digestion was a mess, ruined by rivers of hard-boiled tea he had drunk at roadside stalls all over South Calcutta. Every once in a while, a rumble in his bowels would catch him unawares on the streets, and he would have to sprint for the nearest clean lavatory. This condition was known to us as Tridib's gastric. Once every few months or so, we would answer the doorbell and find him leaning against the wall, his legs tightly crossed, the sweat starting from his forehead. But he wouldn't come in right away. There was a careful etiquette attached to these occasions. My parents and grandmother would collect at the doorway, and ignoring his writhings, would proceed to ask him about his family's doings and whereabouts. And he, in turn, smiling fixedly, would ask them how they were and how I was. And finally, when it had been established to everyone's satisfaction that he had come on a family visit, he would shoot through the door straight into the lavatory. When he emerged again, he would be his usual nonchalant, collected self. He would sink into our good sofa, and the ritual of the family visit would begin. My grandmother would hurry into the kitchen and make him an omelette, a leathery little squiggle studded with green chilies, which would lie balefully on its plate, silently challenging gastric to battle. This was the greatest sign of favor she could show to a visitor, an omelette made with her own hands. It fell to the less favored to feast on my mother's masterly tidbits. Hot chingaras, stuffed with mincemeat and raisins, or crisp little dal puris. Sometimes, watching him as he chewed upon her omelette, she would ask, "And how is gastric?" Or, "Is gastric better now?" Chidib would merely nod casually and change the subject. He didn't like to talk about his digestion. It was the only evidence of prudery I'd ever saw in him. But since I'd always heard my grandmother using that word as a proper noun, I grew up believing that gastric was the name of an organ particular to Tridib, a kind of aching tooth that grew out of his belly button. Of course, I never dared ask to see it. Despite the special omelette, however, my grandmother would not let him stay long. She believed him to be capable of exerting his influence at a distance, like a baneful planet. And since she also believed the male, as a species, to be naturally frail and wayward, she would not allow herself to take the risk of having him for long in our flat where I, or my father, might be tempted to move into his orbit. I didn't mind particularly, for Tridib was never at his best in our flat. I far preferred to run into him at the street corners in our neighborhood. It didn't happen very often. No more than once a month, perhaps. But still, I took his presence on these streets so much for granted that it never occurred to me that I was lucky to have him in Calcutta at all. Tridib's father was a diplomat, an officer in the Foreign Service. He and Maya Devi were always away, abroad or in Delhi. After intervals of 2 or 3 years, they would sometimes spend a couple of months in Calcutta, but that was all. Of Tridib's two brothers, Jatin Kaku, the elder, who was 2 years older than Tridib, was an economist with the UN. He was always away too, somewhere in Africa or Southeast Asia, with his wife and his daughter, Ayla, who was my age.
We've just heard The Shadow Lines by Amitav Ghosh. Previewed the work of Aravind Adiga before. His popular White Tiger, which you'll find on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of August 27, 2011, and his newest book, Last Man in Tower, archived at bookreportradio.com, week of February 4, 2012. In Between the Assassinations, A Novel in Stories, readers are transported to Kittur, India. Of its nearly 200,000 residents, only 89 declare themselves to be without religion or caste. Kittur is an extraordinary crossroads of the brightest minds and the poorest morals, the up-and-coming and the downtrodden. A 12-year-old boy, a gopher at a tea shop near the railway station, is enticed into wrongdoing because a fair-skinned stranger treats him with dignity and warmth. A mosquito repellent sprayer elevates himself to gardener and then chauffeur. A little girl's first act of love for her father is to beg on the street for money to support his drug habit. And the loneliest member of the Marxist-Maoist Party of India falls in love with a young woman in the poorest part of town. This is a brilliant, brave mosaic of Indian life, written with humor, sympathy, and unflinching candor. Harsh Nayyar performs the book.
The little dust-covered creature let his bag drop to the ground. A hand went up to its heart. "I'm a Muslim, sir. We don't do hanky-panky." Ziauddin was small and black, with baby fat in his cheeks, and an elfin grin that exposed big, white, rabbity teeth. He boiled tea for the customers in an enormous, pitted stainless steel kettle, watching with furious concentration as the water seethed, overspilled, and sizzled into the gas flame. Periodically, he dug his palm into one of the battered stainless steel boxes at his side to toss black tea powder or a handful of white sugar or a piece of crushed ginger into the brew. He sucked in his lips, held his breath, and with his left forearm tipped the kettle into a strainer. Hot tea dripped through its clogged pores into small, tapering glasses that sat in the slots of a carton originally designed to hold eggs. Taking the glasses one at a time to the tables, he delighted the rough men who frequented the tea shop by interrupting their conversations with shouts of "One, two, three," as he slammed the glasses down in front of them. Later, the men would see him squatting by the side of the shop, soaking dishes in a large trough filled with murky bilge water, or wrapping greasy samosas in pages ripped from college trigonometry textbooks so they could be home-delivered, or scooping the gunk of tea leaves out of the strainer, or tightening, with a rusty screwdriver, a loose nail in the back of a chair. When a word was said in English, all work stopped. He would turn around and repeat it at the top of his voice. "Sunday, Monday, goodbye, sexy," and the entire shop shook with laughter. Late one evening, just as Ramanna Shetty was ready to close up, Thimma, a local drunk, who bought 3 cigarettes every night, roared with delight to see Ziauddin, his butt and thighs pressed against the giant ice box, shoving it back into the shop, inch by inch. "Look at that whippersnapper," Thimma said, clapping. "The ice box is bigger than him, but what a fighter he is." Calling the whippersnapper close, he put a 25 paisa coin in his palm. The little boy looked at the shopkeeper's eyes for approval. When Ramanna Shetty nodded, he closed his fist and yelped in English, "Thanks you, sir!" One evening, pressing a hand down on the boy's head, Ramanna Shetty brought him over to the drunk and asked, "How old do you think he is? Take a guess." Thimma learned that the whippersnapper was nearly 12. He was the 6th of 11 children from a farm laboring family up in the north of the state. As soon as the rains ended, his father had put him on a bus with instructions to get off at Kittur and walk around the market until someone took him in. "They packed him off without even one paisa," Ramanna said. "This fellow was left entirely to his own wits." He again placed a hand on Ziauddin's head. "Which, I can tell you, aren't much, even for a Muslim." Ziauddin had made friends with the 6 other boys who washed dishes and ran Ramanna's shop and slept together in a tent they had pitched behind the shop. On Sunday at noon, Ramanna pulled down the shutters and slowly rode his blue and cream-colored Bajaj scooter over to the Kittamma Devi temple, letting the boys follow on foot. As he entered the temple to offer a coconut to the goddess, they sat around the green cushion of the scooter, discussing the bold red words written in Kannada on the cornice of the temple. "Honor thy neighbor, thy god." "That means the person in the house next door is your god," one boy theorized. "No, it means God is close to you if you really believe in him," retorted another. "No, it means, Ziauddin tried to explain. But they wouldn't let him finish. "You can't read or write, you hick." When Ramanna shouted for them to come into the temple, Ziauddin darted in with the others a few feet, hesitated, and then ran back to the scooter. "I'm a Muslim. I can't go in."
We've just heard Between the Assassinations by Aravind Adiga. Readers, thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the trip. Make sure you check back here for more literary journeys next week on The Book Report.